Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5406, Arkansas Dairy Cooperative Association, Inc. et al. Appellant versus United States Department of Agriculture et al. Mr. Yale for Appellant, Arkansas Dairy et al. Mr. Ventney for Interveners AgriMark, Inc. et al. Ms. Corcoran for Appalese, U.S. Department of Agriculture et al. And Mr. Rosenbaum for Intervenor, International Dairy Foods Association.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ben Yale, and I represent dairy producers who have been irreparably harmed by changes to minimum prices under the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act. These changes are the sole and direct result of a rule promulgated by the Secretary that was not done in accordance with the law. These producers have standing to bring this claim and are not precluded as a class from being before the court to seek judicial review of this illegal rule. Specifically, the Secretary, in promulgating regulations, was required to, before changing the make allowances, and the make allowances are a factor used to establish that minimum price. Higher the make allowance, the lower the minimum price. The lower the make allowance, the lower the minimum price. And the Congress directed that in establishing in any hearing that began before 2012, that the Secretary was required to do three things. Then the first was to determine the average monthly prices of feed and fuel that were incurred by the dairy producers in the marketing area, very specific direction, and then to consider those costs, or consider more recent data if it had it, and then to consider.
Where does it say that?
It says consider, if it had it, it didn't have that. It does say.
No, it doesn't say that, does it?
Yes, it does. Consider the most recent monthly.
The most recent monthly data.
Feed and fuel prices data available.
And that's a statute, right?
Yes.
And the Secretary has interpreted that statute.
No, it has not interpreted the statute.
It hasn't?
No. In fact, there's no mention of the FCEA's requirement under what is now codified as Section 17G whatsoever in the decision.
But didn't the administrative law judge take judicial notice of the official notice of the monthly NASA agricultural prices, which include prices for feed and fuel?
Your Honor, he did take that. Done by state. The right. Requirement is under the statute that these prices were to be determined into the marketing area.
Well, the Secretary says the marketing area is the country.
But the marketing areas are defined by statute as those regions that, and the Secretary has determined 10 marketing areas by codification found at parts 1001 through 1031, where it has actually defined 10 different distinct marketing areas. And the Act specifically requires the Secretary to look at individual marketing areas in making the decisions, not on a national basis. And also, in answer to that question,
where does it say he can't consider it on a national basis?
Because it says the word is determine average monthly prices of feed and fuel incurred by the dairy producers in the relevant marketing areas.
In the relevant marketing areas.
Class 3 and Class 4, aren't those national markets? Or am I misunderstanding?
In terms of establishing a price, you're right, they are national markets, but the process that, because this is an act that's intended to protect producers and their income, the Congress was concerned and shows that here, that if it needed to, the Secretary was putting too much focus on the cost of the plants as opposed to the cost to the producers and whether or not the producers could in fact produce milk at the prices that they were setting. And so this determination requires them to know what those numbers are and consider those, and that doesn't keep them from, in the end, coming up with a national scheme.
Well, if we assumed, if we didn't agree with you about that, if we thought the Secretary was okay in considering these on a national basis, what would be wrong, then, with what the Secretary did here?
In other words, if you don't accept the premise that they have to determine the prices in the monthly.
No, that they do have to determine the prices, but doing it on a national basis is enough. Then what's the defect here?
Well, I think the effect would be is that the statute...
defect.
What's the defect?
The defect. If the court finds that the national is the marketing area...
No, we wouldn't find it. We would defer to the secretary's
judgment. Defer to the secretary. Right. You know, then at that point, you know, our challenge would then be that there is no indication that he actually determined those prices. You know, there's evidence of those prices in the record. And you're absolutely right, Your Honor, that was judicial notice. They're evidence. There has been no determination by the secretary as to what of those costs it considered by each month and how he considered that as relevant to making these make allowances. In other words, that requirement under the act of the process that the secretary was required to take to get from the raw data to his decision,
let me ask you this. In his final decision, at Joint Appendix 113, he considers the food and fuel prices there, and he decides that they don't justify not changing the make allowance. And then he explains that, I'm in the second column on that page.
Yes.
He then explains that, he then actually rejects it. He says, opponents of increasing make allowances argue that dairy farmer production costs also have increased significantly due to higher energy and fuel costs, due to higher energy and feed costs, right?
That's right. He does say that.
And then he says these are not valid arguments. And then he goes ahead and explains, basically, as I understand it, that these higher fuel and feed costs will be taken account of through the marketplace, that the ultimate price of milk will go up and therefore the blend price will go up. Isn't that what he says here?
He does say that, Your Honor.
Yeah, so why isn't that completely responsive to his obligations under the statute?
Because he has not done it on a marketing area by marketing area.
No, but my whole question is based on the assumption that we don't agree with you about that.
Okay. On that basis, then the point is that he has tilted the act from being one that protects the interests of producers to the interest of protecting the plants, and that the idea that the costs cannot be considered doesn't recognize what Section 608A refers to as this obligation to consider what it does, in fact, cost to produce the product in determining those prices. I don't think the Secretary has the authority to reject out of hand what it costs to produce the milk under this act, because this act is intended to preserve the economic buying power of the producers. And there is nothing in the evidence that showed that, in fact, that those feed costs would come out in the end. It is the projections, are not the projections, by having the actual feed prices and comparing them to the actual minimum prices, he would determine that there is no money in the marketplace to cover those costs. This is the case even to this day. He doesn't compare the two. It's a general rejection, Your Honor. He doesn't say this is what it costs to produce milk, like $14 a hundredweight, and this is what we're going to yield is 12, and therefore, at some point in time, you'll get it back, which is really what that argument is. And what the statute
only says, the part of the statute you're focusing on is the requirement to take account of fuel and feed costs, right?
That's right.
And what I read you, he does that. You just don't like the result he reached, right?
Well, obviously, I didn't like the result, but in this particular case, I don't. The process of actually doing it in the marketing area, there is nowhere in here where we can say that the cost to produce milk in March of 2008 in the Northeast marketing area was this. There's no determination of this. It's never been determined.
You don't like my hypothetical, do you?
Well, I guess I find myself, it's not I don't like it, and I apologize for not wanting to fully embrace it, but it doesn't. You know, the marketing areas, the marketing areas only encompass about 54-55% of the milk produced in the country. His analysis and his determination was for 100% of the milk. And their economic analysis that they did was for all the country. It wasn't just for you know, the marketing areas. I mean, all of the West, California and Idaho, the first and second or third largest producing states, are included in his data that aren't even part of a marketing area. So then that's the part where I think, you know, that I guess I do reject your hypothetical, Your Honor. I'll be honest with you.
You can't reject a hypothetical. I mean, it's just a hypothetical. That's all.
I guess I find it hard to, with the understanding of the dairy industry, I find it hard to coincide it and fit it with what the reality is out there, because the marketing areas are distinct 10 regions that only encompass about 55% of the milk produced. They don't encompass all the rest. And so, therefore, he has not done it in the marketing area. And that's the other requirement that's under Section 18, is you have to do it into the marketing areas, and they haven't done that. So we don't know. And here's the part. It comes back to your question about the national, because this is an important. It's the order in which you get to a national price that's critical, and that is you look at the marketing area and the cost of the producers, and that has to factor into what kind of a national scheme can address all of these factors. They've ignored that bottom tier in terms of what it costs to produce the milk, and they're only looking at what kind of price can we set at a national level. And Congress, unhappy with the one make allowance that was decided in 2006 and 2007, comes out with a decision and says, you've got to look at this number, and they didn't.
Are you relying, I'm just curious about something you just said about the statute. Are you relying on the on this third sentence in the AAMA subsection 18? Is that the one you're relying on?
We had two claims. That was one of our reliances.
But that doesn't apply to this case, does it?
The one regarding the consideration of cost of feed and fuel. Or the one, the third sentence, or the issue of the parity price?
Isn't it the fourth sentence that applies here? Because this is a revision based on changed circumstances, correct?
Oh, I see the answer. You're looking at the decision made in the Lansing Dairy, the issue of whether or not we're looking at changed circumstances.
Right. Isn't the changed circumstances sentence the one that governs this case?
I would say that that statute, if you look at that provision in the Act, and you look at the congressional record when it was promulgated, mm-hmm. made it clear that the consideration of these factors were to be made not only in the promulgation of the order, but in the amendments of the order.
That's not in the statute, is it?
There is an interpretation of the statute as unclear, as I think Lansing Dairy acknowledged, that there's an unclearness in terms of whether it applies or it doesn't.
What's unclear?
What's
unclear?
Whether or not the consideration of the cost of feed and fuel, or cost of feed and production, is to apply in modifying the minimum prices as opposed to just creating them in an original order. And the legislative history of the Act made it clear that...
Well, I was asking about the language of the statute.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, the third sentence says you have to consider feed and fuel, correct?
Right.
And the fourth sentence, which talks about revising these, doesn't say anything about feed and fuel prices.
But it does to include these factors.
It does.
There is and that antecedent would be all, as I would read it.
It says, such thereafter as a secretary, et cetera, change circumstances, he shall, after due notice, make adjustments. That's all it says.
Oh, that's right, it does. But at the same time that it doesn't include the rest of it, it doesn't exclude that. It's just saying that they are not fixed. In other words, the secretary doesn't have to fix a price that lasts forever. He gets to modify it as the economy changes. But the standards that he has to apply to make those changes, he hasn't been carte blanche to come up with a whole new criteria outside of the statute. He still has to confine himself to the criteria of the statute in terms of what he does. And that's how I would explain that distinction, Your Honor. So, with those situations in mind, is that we believe that this Act, the Secretary has not given us the process of consideration of the factors that's most important to dairy farmers, and that's its cost, their cost, and setting these minimum prices in a program that was designed to ensure the economic survival of dairy farmers. And instead has imposed considerations that benefit a few processors who have the ability to move that price onto the consumers and onto the marketplace. The producers do not. And therefore, the producers are stuck with the prices and at a point where they are not able to economically be viable. And it's the failure to actually address the actual numbers, not in theory, the actual numbers, which we believe the word determination requires, that has led to this illegal act, and therefore it should have been set aside. So if there's any other question, Mr. Ventney is going to talk about jurisdiction and that issue. So if there's nothing else on this issue, I'll be willing to sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is John Ventney. I represent defendant interveners Agrimark et al. On the merits, I sit on that side of the table. But on standing and claim preclusion, I sit on that side of the table, much the same way that actually Mr. Yale sat with me on the Alto Dairy case in the Seventh Circuit a while back. He was opposed on the merits, but with me on standing. And Alto Dairy is a case that's referred to and distinguished.
You use standing, and the district court used that phrase. That's not quite right, is it? I mean,
It's
not claim preclusion either. It's whether Congress has precluded judicial review here, right?
In essence, was the question. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court, Justice O'Connor, wrote the Arbrough v. Y&H decision and referred to the, no offense to district courts intended, but the inclination of some district courts to give drive-by jurisdictional rulings where things are standing, to call it jurisdiction, to call it claim preclusion. There are distinct analytical processes that apply to claim preclusion that are different than apply to prudential standing, that are different than apply to Article III standing. And those things are mixed up frequently, and they were mixed up here. My friends on the defendant's side on the issue of standing have correctly referred to this as a claim preclusion question. standing looks at the complaint, but this is a claim preclusion question. And on that issue, they rely heavily on the Supreme Court's decision in Block versus Community Nutrition Institute, drawing analogy from the CNI, Community Nutrition Institute's discussion on claim preclusion for consumers. In that same, producers were not suing, consumers were suing. But in that same decision, and this is the most important part that is omitted and frequently omitted by anybody that refers to CNI, on page 347 of the decision, the preclusion issue turns ultimately on whether Congress intended for a class of potential plaintiffs, I'm inserting that, a class to be relied upon to challenge agency disregard of law. On that proposition, the Block v. CNI court cites to Barlow v. Collins. It concludes, the structure of this act indicates that Congress intended only producers and handlers, not consumers, to ensure that statutory objectives would be realized. Producers. And you go to, so Barlow v. Collins, which is referred to three times in Brennan's concurring decision twice in the CNI v. the Block v. CNI case, refers to Barlow v. Collins. That is the standard for claim preclusion. The companion case, Association of Data Processing, cited immediately before, is the standard that governs standing. On both scores, and both cases are cited by Block v. CNI, producers have standing. The claim here, with which we do not disagree, is that the price is too low. What handler is going to challenge a price that's too low? Nobody. No handler. And handlers, in fact, that would be a third party. That would be a vicarious claim. There has been a lot of discussion in this circuit on vicarious champions, virtual representatives. Producers only claim where the secretary does not go far enough is to come to a court and claim, as they did in this case, we don't agree with these producers, but we do agree and must agree that they have standing.
But if you go to the end of that section, in I call it block, you call it CNI.
Okay.
Justice O'Connor writes, for these reasons, we think it clear that Congress intended that judicial review of market orders issued under the Act ordinarily be confined to suits brought by handlers. I mean, producers don't fare very well under her analysis. Exhaustion requirement.
I disagree entirely, because handlers are the regulated parties. Enforcement may be brought against handlers. The 15A process is co-joined with the enforcement process. If you go to 15B, it says enforcement will not be delayed. The Rizika case of the Supreme Court, Rock Royal, all talk about exhaustion in relation to enforcement. There is no and can never be any enforcement against producers. Producers are not regulated, but they are the primary beneficiary class. In fact, if you go to the end of the...
Aren't they protected under the Act with the two-thirds and one-half voting?
Absolutely not. In fact, the cases that have come before the Supreme Court, Stark versus Wickard, Zuber versus Allen.
Don't those all stand for the proposition that there may be judicial review to challenge once the price is set, but in the process, when you're challenging the process of how the price gets set, don't they stand for the proposition that judicial review is more limited than you argue here?
Absolutely not. Zuber v. Allen talks about the need of producers and of courts to protect the minority producers against the will of the majority.
Once the price is set.
Is there any help in distinguishing between minimum price and blended price in trying to parse out what the courts are looking at?
Are we talking about standing or claim preclusion?
Well, I'm just piggybacking on, I think, Judge Griffith's question, where he talks about price. I mean, the objection here is, as I understand it, in part, a deduction. And at least some of the cases have maybe mixed the terms.
There is a minimum class price under Section 608 C5A and a minimum producer price, blend prices under 5B. The producers are the beneficiaries under 5B. The handlers are regulated under 608 C5A. It's the handler price that's enforced. But handlers are also conduits for the blend price to producers. The Secretary, in fact, serves, and Zuber talks about this, in effect, as a trustee. And producers are the trust beneficiaries. If the court were to conclude that producers, contrary to Block v. CNI, that producers could not sue as trust beneficiaries for breach of trust by the trustee, I think that would violate the principle of Stark. It would violate the principle of Block and would violate the closing remark in Block v. CNI is that judicial review of producers' complaint was necessary to ensure achievement of the Act's most fundamental objectives, to wit, the protection of producers of milk and milk products. It is when a complaint genuinely asserts, or when producers bring a complaint on their own behalf, on their own interest.
Counsel, where was that language from Block?
I'm looking at
the page number.
Yes, 352, top of the page.
Thanks.
That's how it ends. It may be. No, I think it's absolutely unequivocal that producers have, under Stark and under Block, are not precluded for bringing suit. Everything else has to do with standing. If, in fact, producers, I think the fear has been raised that producers might bring a suit to circumvent the opportunity for handlers to bring a claim, well, in that case, it's still a standing question. But it's understanding, ordinarily, parties may not raise a claim to protect the rights of third parties. One may only prosecute one's own claim or one's own interest. So understanding, once the content of the complaint, not the right to be there, but the content of the complaint is looked at, in that kind of abuse, the court could look at and would look at the complaint to see, are you raising your own rights or somebody else's? But if you rely only on the 15A process, Your Honors, that same principle applies before the Secretary. The Secretary said handlers may not raise the rights of producers. In fact, the Secretary precludes producers from even intervening in that process. So this kind of complaint...
Isn't it a complaint about the use of the settlement fund and not about pricing?
Which complaint?
The language you just referred to in 352 about protecting producers, isn't that referring to when decisions are made about how to distribute settlement fund after pricing is set, there's clearly a role for them there. I mean, Stark teaches us that, Block teaches that. But isn't the distinction between judicial review for contesting an action after a price has been set, how you distribute the funds, how the settlement fund works, as opposed to what you're seeking here, and that's judicial review of the decision itself as to what the price would be. Isn't that a principal distinction between these cases?
It is a factual distinction, but I don't think it's a principled.
Stark and Block, Stark in particular, was dealing with the case where the price had been set and there was a dispute over who got the money, right? But not over the price itself.
Absolutely, that's what Stark was about. Right. But that's not a principled decision.
Stark is not a principled decision.
No, that fact is not a government.
I don't think you meant your answer.
Right.
I think you want a different answer to Judge Griffin's question.
What I meant was
we can't do much with unprincipled decisions.
Okay.
By our bosses.
Stark involved a factual context. All right. The court in Stark looked at the law of standing at the time and claim preclusion at the time and says, okay, on these facts, producers have to be protected. Producers are the beneficiaries. They have a claim they can make. I don't think that one can attribute to the Stark court an intent to apply a broad standard to hypothetical unknown facts in the future. The standard was producers are beneficiaries. They have an interest to protect. They can come to court, but the claim preclusion standard was more firmly established in Barlow v. Collins, which is the standard which the Block v. C&I court referred to, and it's Barlow v. Collins that should be read on the desk, juxtaposed with Block v. C&I. To see what the court intended, and if one looks at Judge Scalia's dissenting decision in C&I v. Block before this court, before the circuit court, Judge Scalia explained that why producers have standing, are not precluded from making claims where the secretary doesn't go far enough, and handlers have the right to complain where the secretary goes too far. And by those two things, the secretary's breach of his statutory authority are completely covered. Without one of them, they're not covered. And it was Scalia's dissenting decision that the Solicitor General relied on most heavily in agreeing that producers have the right to sue. And it was Judge Scalia's dissenting decision, in effect, that was incorporated by the Supreme Court's decision in Block v. C&I when it referred to producers and handlers have a right to sue where their claims, as the Seventh Circuit put, producers where they are pinched. And that was the Alto case. And by the way, I should say, the Alto case did not, in this court below, totally missed a very essential thing. There are no producer handlers that are plaintiffs here. Judge Sullivan thought there were. There aren't. There were no producer handlers in Alto. Judge Sullivan thought there were. There aren't. I argued the Alto case. Producer handler is a very different animal than these cooperatives who, in a role, also have service handlers. They are representatives of producers. They are, in effect, trade associations representing individual farmers. If the Secretary's decision had gone the other way, my clients might be in this court because their primary complaint to the Secretary was that their producers, Agrimark's producers, were getting an unfair and unequal minimum blend price because they were artificially subsidizing the producer settlement fund so that so that Mr. Yale's clients got an unfair greater amount. It worked both ways. It's a uniform price. And in similar context, in the 1985 Farm Bill, Congress also talked about some burdens borne by cooperatives as handlers that result in their producer members not getting a uniform price. It is the impact on producers. Again, we need the balance of regulatory excess. Handlers have the right to complain, and where the secretary doesn't go far enough, producers have a right to complain. And it's the fundamental protection. Producers, milk, and the fundamental objective is protection of producers. The court did not limit protection of producers to money paid into and out of the fund. In fact, the pool, that's just a clearinghouse for money. The pool is all of the money that is paid by all handlers for all milk and all classes. The fund is the clearinghouse for that pool. It's the pool settlement fund. But the pool is the whole amount of money by everybody. And in this case, these producers are essentially claiming that my clients are not paying enough into the pool so that they would get more. And our claim before the secretary, we're paying too much into the pool. It's not something that is an enforcement or can ever be an enforcement issue genuinely brought by a handler, because no handler can with a straight face claim that the secretary made a mistake because they're making him pay too little. There must be a claim by producers for that, and that's what's made in this case. As to the merits, I'll leave that to Mr. Rosenbaum. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Kelsey Brown Corker, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of Agriculture. As Judge Griffith mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court expressly stated in Block that in enacting the AMAA, Congress clearly intended the judicial review of orders issued under the Act ordinarily be confined to suits brought by handlers.
And but Block, Block left Stark. Block didn't overrule Stark, did it?
Yeah, the Supreme Court stated in Block that Stark involved an exception to the rule for a certain category of claims brought by producers. Mm-hmm. And this court recently affirmed in Edeline Dairy that the Stark exception only applies in a narrow category of cases that share a distinct characteristic that is not present here.
But Edeline Dairy also said that if there was a definite injury and no other remedy, it would be different.
Edeline Dairy referred to the personal right requirement of Stark, and that's also...
Why isn't this case just like Stark? I don't get the distinction between this and Stark. In Stark, the court identified a... Stark says that there was a definite injury, right, to the producers in that case.
Yeah, and that's the portion
a
of
a pro tanto reduction in the amount of money they got.
Yeah, the first half of Stark is a discussion of Article III standing, mm-hmm. And the zone of interest requirement. Those are separate issues, as Mr. Ventney mentioned earlier. No one is challenging here the plaintiff's Article III standing or that they're within the zone of interest. Statutory preclusion of judicial review is an independent requirement that the plaintiffs have failed to satisfy here. And the Stark exception applies in cases where the dispute is one solely between producers.
I thought in Stark the court found that they had a cause of action.
Yes, that's the second portion of Stark. Stark addresses both of those issues.
That's not the part I'm looking at here?
The first half of the opinion discusses standing more generally, and the second half looks to the cause of action question. And in finding a cause of action, the court...
No, it says when personal rights are created by federal statute, the silence of Congress, right?
Right.
Is not to be considered. They're talking here about a cause of action, not Article III standing. And then... And then the court says that that there was a pro tanto reduction, which is exactly the same here. Now, counsel was just up here. He said, well, or I guess the argument is, I see in your brief, the argument is, well, there's a difference between this case and Stark because one involves a settlement fund and the other doesn't, right?
Yes.
Is that?
Yeah. Well, I think that when you read Stark in conjunction with Block and then also in the Edeline Dairy decision, and I think this court's earlier decision in Benson, the delineation of the two categories of cases turns on the extent to which the mechanisms of the AMAA.
But Benson was not a producer case. In Benson, the plaintiff there was suing in his capacity, right?
Benson.
It was a case about.
Benson of the plaintiffs for challenging.
Wasn't it about handlers, though?
Benson, I believe, is a producer case where the producers were challenging. They claimed that they did not get notice in hearing. When the court said was that their interest.
But these were producers who were also handlers.
Yes, I don't think the decision.
That's why that's different from this case. Correct?
That's one difference that this case. That's also a case that's prior to Stark and Block. When we think about Stark, Block, and Edeline Dairy, again, the delineation there is whether or not the AMAA has a mechanism for resolving the dispute. And Congress clearly contemplated that the AMAA would resolve disputes where there were competing interests between handlers and producers. They gave referendum power to the producers.
Didn't Stark reject that argument with respect to producers?
What Stark said was that that mechanism is not does not fit situations where this dispute is solely between producers, where the challenge action puts more money in the hands of some producers and less money in the hands of others, and handlers have no interest in the outcome.
Well,
and that
the
makes
language
sense.
It's much broader in Stark, isn't it? Page that Judge Tatel's referring to, where it talks about how we have to look at congressional intent, and then it talks about the scheme, and then it says, well, producers, you know, have no administrative remedy here.
Right, and then you move forward to the Block decision, and Block describes Stark as a case that turned on the fact that the dispute was, again, solely between producers, so the mechanisms of the AMAA were not sufficient were not intended to address those sorts of situations. What we have here is the epitome of the kind of dispute that can be resolved through the mechanisms of the AMAA.
Well, who would challenge this?
Yeah, the question, to clarify something that Mr. Vetney was talking about earlier, the question is not whether handlers and producers have the same interest. The question is whether they both have an interest in the challenged action. In Stark and the cases that have followed Stark, handlers had no interest whatsoever. Here, handlers' interests are in competition with the interests of producers. And when there are competing interests between handlers and producers, the mechanisms of the AMAA are intended to govern.
Well, what do you do with Stark saying that the mechanisms available to producers, were insufficient here?
They were insufficient there because the challenged action was one that put more money in the hands of some producers and less money in the hands of others. So the majority could impose its will on the minority in approving the challenged order. What we have here is an order that will have a uniform impact on all producers. And that goes to Judge Tatel's point earlier about what Stark meant by personal right. The reference to personal right in that context is not a reference to injury in the Article III sense or even the zone of interest test. It's a reference to the producers having a unique interest in the challenged action, a situation where handlers and consumers and the public in general do not have an interest in the dispute. In those circumstances, the AMAA does not have any mechanism for resolving the dispute, so courts have found that judicial review is appropriate. Again, this is the epitome of a case that can be resolved through the AMAA. And that is why the plaintiffs are precluded from bringing.
And where do you find in Stark the focus on the fact that this point about the competition between the handlers and the producers? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I'm mostly describing Stark in the way that it's been described since. So at the end of the Block decision, there's a discussion of the fact that the the dispute in Stark was one that was solely between producers. You also get that from Edeline Derry more recently in talking about the Stark exception as a narrow rule only applied.
But in both cases, and I mean by both cases, Stark and this case, you have, when you get right down to the core of it, regardless of who's in competition, what you have here are farmers challenging the legality of a milk marketing order that reduces their payments. Correct.
I think the problem with that theory of Stark is that the exception would swallow the rule. It's hard to imagine a case in which producers would be bringing a claim that didn't have some sort of injurious effect on them. And the Supreme Court...
Stark basically rejected that, said there are other ways to handle that. I'm looking at your block site, though.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What page of block are you in?
I am between 351 and 352.
All right, so...
Oh, sorry, no, I'm looking at the part that Mr. Vetney was challenging earlier. I'm looking at 346.
346?
346 begins right after the say to Barlow. It is clear that Congress... Oh, now I'm looking at the wrong place. Sorry, let me...
I see Block describing Stark. But I don't see quite the same limitation you suggest.
I'm sorry, I turned the page to look at the quote that Mr. Vetney was...
Well, you know, it's discussing Stark. What is it, on 351?
It is clear. I have the quote memorized, but I...
I know, I'm trying to find it.
The page.
I mean, they're talking about personal rights. Right. Implicitly authorized producer suits. No forum in which this aspect of the Secretary's actions would be challenged.
The quote is, it is clear that Congress intended in enacting the AMAA.
Well, I'll look for it, all right?
But we have it cited. I'm sorry. I got myself in trouble when I turned it.
Has this court viewed Block as limiting Stark that way?
I think that Edeline Derry certainly does.
Edeline Derry, I mean, in terms of the holding there.
It involved different issues, but it did describe Stark as a...
It just says, ordinarily, all right?
That's right. And then in Edeline Derry, this court described that as a narrow exception, that Stark involved a narrow exception.
The question is, are we in that narrow exception?
If a case that is the epitome of a dispute between handlers and producers falls into the exception, then it's not clear when the rule would ever apply. And the Supreme Court unanimously contemplated in Block that these cases would ordinarily be confined to those suits that are brought by handlers. And so I don't know how you could reconcile allowing this case to go forward with that
Block
language.
I just don't see all this in Block. All right? Block was saying that, the handlers can take care of all the consumer interests that the consumers are asserting here, and that the producers, there's a role here for them as well. But
Edeline Derry also read Block as creating or as recognizing Stark as creating only a narrow exception. So you'd have to reconcile.
Been over that. All right. I get your message.
I have a few more seconds. I'm happy to answer any questions on the merit.
I have two questions. Yeah.
Okay.
The first is procedural. This case comes to us from the denial of a motion for preliminary injunction.
Yes.
Right. So do we have to go? Are we looking at this case through that lens, or are we just looking at the merits here?
You're looking at this case to determine whether it was proper for the district court to deny the preliminary injunction. Now, in this case, the district court's rationale for denying the preliminary injunction turned in large part on the merits.
We don't have to go through. You're not suggesting that we have to go through. We're not looking at this in terms of likely success on the merits, are we?
No, I think that's right. The district court found absolutely no success on the merits, both because they were statutorily precluded from bringing their claim and also because they misinterpreted the statute and also because the record belied their claims. And so in that sense, in denying their preliminary injunction motion, the district court also squashed any hope they might have had of moving forward with their cause of action. And I think if this court were to affirm on any of those grounds, when this case goes back to the district court, the plaintiffs would also be precluded from making any of their merits arguments.
So if we were to agree with the government, it wouldn't go back to the district court, would it?
I think technically it...
For anything other than dismissal.
No, yes, that's right.
Okay. My other question relates to your argument about maybe you were going to talk about this, FCEA
yes.
hearing question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When I first read your brief, I thought, yeah, you've got to be right about the argument about the hearing here.
Right.
But I'm curious about your reaction to the producer's argument that in this statute, hearing isn't limited to evidentiary hearing. That hearing has to mean something more than the evidentiary hearing because the secretary simply can't do some of the things he has to do under the statute at the evidentiary hearing.
I don't think there's any evidence.
For example, let me just focus you on this. It's the third element, right? Consider the most recent monthly
right.
feed and fuel. Okay, that you can do at an evidentiary hearing.
Right.
Three, consider those prices in determining whether or not make allowances, right?
Right.
And their argument is that's not what happens in an evidentiary hearing. That's when the secretary, quote, considers those prices in determining whether or not to adjust make allowances. That's the decision the secretary makes in the ultimate regulation.
Yeah,
and so under this statute, oddly enough, the word hearing includes the whole process. That's their argument.
Yeah, and what's the matter with most that creates an ambiguity in the provision that should be resolved.
What's ambiguous about that?
Well, the word hearing, as we explained in our...
No, the word hearing is, but when you look at the statute in context, there isn't any... Are they wrong that the secretary simply can't do what subparagraph 3 requires at the evidentiary hearing?
Well,
that's the ultimate
hearing
decision.
is governed by an administrative law judge, so I think there's a tension between that provision and the word hearing that creates an ambiguity. We make the point in our brief about hearing the word hearing because the government has an institutional interest in making sure that the word hearing is interpreted according to its ordinary meaning. I think this court...
Yeah, but Congress has... the argument here is that Congress, for whatever reason, has decided to use the word hearing in a different way. I can certainly understand
the
government's desire to want to have hearing have a consistent meaning, but the argument here is that this statute doesn't allow that in this particular situation.
I think that there would need to be significantly more evidence of Congress's intent in juxtaposing the word hearing with that final provision in order to find that Congress intended hearing to mean something other than what hearing normally means. That said, we think this court can just as easily affirm on the ground that it's obvious from the record that the secretary did in fact determine the average monthly prices and consider those prices based on the sites that you mentioned earlier. There's also record evidence at JA 235 where the secretary's economists are discussing the way in which feed and fuel prices were incorporated into their econometric modeling. So I think that's an easy question for this court to resolve the case on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel for the International Dairy Foods Association.
Yes, Your Honor. Stephen Rosenbaum. I represent handlers. We certainly endorse the government's arguments on the merits and on standing. I think I would be remiss, though, not to mention that we are here on a preliminary injunction where the standard review is abuse of discretion. And the court below did find in our favor on all issues, including...
And if it's a legal issue... Just assume, take a hypothetical, okay, court denies a preliminary injunction because it thinks plaintiffs are unlikely to prevail on what is a pure legal question. And it comes up to us. Why would we have many cases where in that situation we just decide the legal issue and that's the end of the case.
Well,
if in fact the district court was wrong. If we think the plaintiffs are right on the law, or the government's right on the law, why would we send it back I don't understand that.
Well, I think the Supreme Court has made clear that whenever a preliminary injunction is being reviewed, all the factors have to be addressed and weighed.
We have many cases here where
Your Honor,
we get cases on appeal from a preliminary injunction, and the opinion simply resolves a legal issue and sends it back. End of case.
Well, I think you have to address the public interest here, and
You're not answering my question. You're just stating your conclusion.
There are four factors that are part of the determination whether a preliminary injunction should be granted or denied. And even in a circumstance in which you conclude that there's a likelihood of success on the merits, there still is the question, or substantial likelihood of success on the merits, there still would be the question whether the balance of harms dictates that a preliminary injunction be granted.
Suppose in the end, this is a hypothetical, okay? Nothing more than a hypothetical. Suppose I concluded that setting aside all these questions about cause of action, the hearing, suppose I ultimately concluded that the Secretary had properly considered the feed and fuel prices in the in its decision. Okay?
Yes.
Well, what's left for the district court to do?
I don't think there's anything left for the
district. That's my whole point.
You
agree with counsel for the government that we're basically looking at the legal issue here.
I think the legal issue is critical, obviously, Your Honor, but I think that if you were to conclude that the balance of harms, Your Honor, there's a specific finding by the Department of Agriculture that it's critical that the make allowance be raised because otherwise handlers cannot cover their costs.
Let me try the question differently. Suppose I agreed with the petitioner here, or suppose I agreed with the government that there was no cause of action. What would I do?
Well, if there's no cause of action, then there's nothing left, certainly.
Okay.
Certainly.
So in that case, I wouldn't consider the balance of harms, right?
That's right. Where
would I consider the balance of harms in this case?
You would only consider the balance of harms if you concluded that there was, which we don't believe there is, a reasonable likelihood that the plaintiffs would succeed on the merits. Nonetheless, one would have to go on and consider whether the balance of harms.
You have another point you want to make?
Warrants. Yes, Your Honor. I would like to return to standing briefly, Your Honor. The Block Court held that judicial review is ordinarily confined to suits brought by handlers. The gist of the plaintiff's position is that, in fact, judicial review is never confined to suits brought by handlers, rather that farmers can always bring those lawsuits if they are affected by the government's action. That is we believe that's irreconcilable with the language of Block. In Block, the court also said that when a statute provides a detailed mechanism for judicial consideration for particular issues at the behest of particular persons, that's a quote, judicial review on behalf of others is, quote, impliedly precluded, end quote. Yet the plaintiffs would suggest that, in fact, in any circumstance in which farmers are unhappy with what happened, they can bring a lawsuit. That is not reconcilable with Block. We think that there is a very clear distinction drawn in Stark as interpreted by Block, namely, what the minimum price is something that the farmers cannot challenge. How the money's collected are then distributed to farmers is something the farmers can challenge, and that's because handlers, my clients, have no interest in how the money's distributed. But we do have an interest, obviously, in what the minimum price is. And there is a symmetry in the statute. My clients, handlers, have no vote whether or not a marketing order goes into effect or stays in effect. We have no voting rights whatsoever. We do, though, have the right to challenge the legality of the terms of orders after we exhaust our administrative remedies. Farmers, on the other hand, have a different set of rights. They have the unfettered discretion to determine whether the order either comes into effect or stays into effect. They have a two-thirds voting requirement for orders coming into effect and majority vote for orders staying in effect.
What about our decision in Blair?
Your Honor, I believe that all the decisions by this court are decisions that fall within the Stark exception. That is to say, decisions in which the challenge related to the sharing of money rather than the question of what the minimum price is. This court's decision in Benson clearly, we think, says correctly that farmers cannot challenge a price as being too low. That was the interpretation.
Well, look at Blair. Blair says, since this differential is payable out of the equalization pool, the deduction reduces pro tanto, the amount actually received by producers for their milk. Appellants, i.e. producers, therefore have standing.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. That the equalization pool and the settlement fund, those are synonymous terms in this context.
Not producer versus producer. That's what I'm trying to get at.
No, these were the questions of what... No, the payable out of the equalization pool meant that it was a question of how the monies were shared. These were not minimum price questions. This was not the question of what's the minimum price for milk. This was the question of how is the money shared based upon where a farmer's farm was located. And that is stark, a stark issue. Mm-hmm. And I think in footnote 15 of the Blair decision, the court so concluded. This is different. Our case is different. It goes to the heart of the distinction that we think this court drew in Benson and that the Supreme Court drew in Stark, and indeed that the Supreme Court in the Block case concluded in interpreting what Stark was. In the words of the Supreme Court in the Block case, Stark was a situation where, quote, in which, quote, handlers had no financial interest in the fund or its use, end quote. That's Block at pages 351 and 52. That's the circumstance under which farmers do have standing, or I should say do have a cause of action under the review mechanism set up under the AMAA.
The Seventh Circuit has ruled the other way on this issue, right?
Well, Your Honor, the only court that I would view as having ruled the other way is the Eighth Circuit in the Minnesota Milk case over a strong dissent. Alto Dairy, the language of Alto Dairy is not conducive to our position, but the holding in Alto Dairy...
What does that mean? Does that mean
it means that it was
ruled the other way?
It means it was a Stark case, and so it's distinguishable.
And why it's distinguishable? Why?
Because that the issue there was how the money was shared among farmers. The issue was it was not a minimum price case. Uh-huh. So if you look at the actual, if you look at the result of the case.
Judge Posner actually dismissed Stark, didn't he? Thought it was not relevant because it was before the APA. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. I mean, well, or at least that the AMAA was enacted before the APA.
Right.
I don't see how you reconcile that with the Supreme Court holding in Block, which obviously looked to the language of the AMAA right. for its determination of what rights were being created. Unless there are any other questions.
Further? Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to address this issue of this producer settlement fund and this computation issue because there's...
Counsel for appellants.
Pardon?
Just want to get it on the record. Who's speaking?
Counsel? Oh, I'm sorry. Ben Yale on behalf of the appellants. I apologize. This is, there's a confusion here that should not exist. The formulas, these rules, these regulations you find at parts 1000 through parts 1131 establish formulas whereby information is gathered on a weekly and monthly basis. Prices, minimum prices are set. Handlers are assessed these prices. There's different charges that are added and subtracted from that for locations and
Are you going to talk about the cause of action issue? Or?
Yeah. What I want to get to the cause of action is that the idea that once the formulas are set and then later on the money is getting paid according to the formulas is a distinction in which they're really it doesn't make any difference because once the formulas are created by rule, the administrator is required to comply with that regulation. And that was what was going on in Stark and in Zuber, that the regulation said this is how you make the money payment distribution. So the underlying challenge was, what is the formula that sets the minimum price? And in Stark, it happened to be how it was distributed on nearby differentials. you know, in Alto Dairy, it had to do with pooling. Lansing Dairy, it had to do with zone differentials for different places and how that money was allocated. Those are the formulas that set the minimum price. And you can't let the facts dictate the law. The law is that if the minimum price is too low because the secretary has failed to comply with the law, then the producers have to have a remedy. And the remedy isn't as a minority to be able to vote uselessly in a referendum. The remedy is to be able to come to court and say, the law says you have to do this, you didn't do it, and therefore we're entitled to relief. Otherwise, we have this absurd situation under a producer-oriented statute that if the processors get a price too high, they have a remedy, and if the producers get a price too low, we have to say thank you. And that is not America, and that's not what Stark said. And I would say on Posner, I think he did start to say that the APA would, because he represented Darby versus Cisneros, and how the APA should be melded with the AMAA. And if you look at Benson, you'll see that that's really a 701A2 decision. It's saying that you're precluded, not precluded, it's left to agency discretion. And that the issue that they're arguing, taking Benson, is that it's a 70A1 that we're precluded as a matter of law. And the Supreme Court says that has to be absolutely clear because the record, and it says this in Stark, it says it in CNI and the others, is that you need to give deference to judicial review unless it's clear otherwise. So I think that that fits. But that formula, whether you call it minimum prices, you call it make allowances, you call it differentials, you call it nearby differentials, it's all the same thing. It determines how much money a producer gets. And once it's put into play, it goes. If the secretary sets rules that are illegal, then they ought to be able to be challenged. The other part that I wanted to point out is that Stark has not been overruled. Block made it very clear that that was a consumer case. I think anything else is dicta. Now, I want to switch over to one other issue, and I want to address because I think this is important. Because the marketing area is a specific division of regions of the country that's mandated by statute under the AMAA, and the secretary has specifically at 10 different places in the CFR defined 10 distinct non-overlapping marketing areas that encompass approximately 50-some percent of the milk produced. And each of those has their own formulas. They have their own minimum prices that are yielded because they have different use of milk that goes into it. They have different differentials. They have different allocation, zoning, pooling, and all these things. So all of those end up with completely different blended prices. Even with the same national 3 and 4 price, they end up with completely different blended prices. And the only way the secretary can make a decision whether or not the overarching purpose of the AMAA to protect producers is taken care of is to look at this is what it costs to produce milk in this marketing area. This is what the blend is going to be yielded in this area. Is this enough? And you cannot answer that question by deciding whether a processing plant in Idaho is going to make money to determine whether or not a producer in Florida makes enough money under these provisions. He has to do it on a market area by market area basis. The statute does not allow for national. The analysis that they talk about, this model, is a projection. It's not historic. They didn't determine what the costs were. They project into the future nationally, not locally, not regionally, and it's not even actual costs. It's a projection. So it's a consideration. It's helpful, but it doesn't comply fully with the statute. And that's all we're asking, is we want the law to be applied to protect the producers. And it's not asking that much. The law said as a part of a hearing. It didn't say the hearing. It said as a part of the hearing. And there's multiple ways in which the state secretary could have appended something to that hearing record to comply with the act. So I think that there's clearly that we are entitled to have this sent back to the court with orders that we win on the law and that we had jurisdiction, we were not precluded, and the secretary should take this set aside that rule and come back and do it right. That's all we're asking. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.